Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the economic front these days, the buzzword is crisis. Wall Street, housing, credit crunch, falling dollar, recession. The headlines are scary, and now they're full of proposed fixes, too. But what works, what's needed, and what's a waste? This hour on Point, the big picture, with Bigfoot economist and former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers. Joining me now in the studio is Larry Summers. He was U.S. Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration and until 2006, president of Harvard University. He's a big thinker and a big player, now a professor at Harvard and a managing director of the Wall Street hedge fund D.E. Shaw. Larry Summers, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
Are we in crisis?
We're in a very difficult situation. Most likely, the economy is in recession. The real economy will probably get worse before it gets better. And the financial system is going through strains where the health of even some of the largest institutions is called into question, of a kind we haven't seen in this country in many, many years. Fortunately, there have been some actions taken to contain the problem, and so the fever has perhaps broken slightly in the last several weeks, but we remain with a very, very difficult situation.
Well, what about that? The fever broken on Wall Street. We saw a big up day this week. We down a little bit as it opens this morning. We don't know where that's going to go. But do you have the sense that this may all be bottoming out? We may be turning a corner, or is this just a pause before more calamity? Is it possible to really take a good temperature on that at this point?
I don't think anybody can make those kinds of predictions with confidence. And anyone out there who believes that someone they're listening to knows the answer to that question should run in the opposite direction. My sense is that while it came slowly and policy was somewhat behind the curve, you've now seen a good deal of action. You've seen the interest rate cut to 2.25% from 5.25%. You've seen the commitment of well over $100 billion in new federal spending to stimulate the economy. You've seen the willingness of the Federal Reserve in an unprecedented way to lend money to financial institutions to keep the credit markets going. You've seen more generally a willingness of the Fed to do what it takes to keep the financial system going. You're seeing in a variety of ways a lot of support from the government for the mortgage market start to take form. All of these developments offer the prospect that while the real economy is going to go through a difficult time for some time to come, that there may be some reductions in pressure in the financial system. But there could very easily be more serious shocks. And it continues to be the case that there are losses in the financial system that have not yet been recognized. And it's going to be the case that at a time when more people probably need to borrow more money, more cities need to borrow more money, that our financial institutions, because of their past losses, are going to be under great pressure to contract. And so there's certainly a possibility that we'll again start to see a vicious cycle where lending contracts and therefore spending and asset values go down, and therefore there's more pressure for lending to contract, and you see a return to the kind of implosion we were seeing a month or two ago. I actually think we're very much at a cusp, and this could go in either direction, and that's always what makes a market. Some people are buying and some people are selling, and it reflects exactly that kind of divergence of opinion.
We're not going to spend the whole hour testing the bottom here. There's a lot to look at on fixes that people are proposing and some that we're, as you say, already in the midst of. And yet in my lifetime, I have never seen the Great Depression referred to as often as I have in the last 6 months. I've just never seen it before. It was always something in history. It wasn't a, you know, that sort of calamitous fear, potential, what could happen in the economy has never been as much in the air as it has been in these last months. What has brought us to a place where there could be that level of concern? How do you explain the sort of fundamental factors that have brought us to a point where people are worried about potentially even that kind of meltdown?
You know, if you look at financial crises, they're all the same. They're all different, but in perhaps a deeper sense, they're all the same. Greed and leverage. People borrow money to bid up assets. As people see those assets going up, they decide they're very safe. They decide they're an easy way to make money. They borrow more money, and they go up further. Greed takes hold. The sense of fear is lost. Prices get to unsustainable levels. Lending levels take off. But trees don't grow to the sky. And then the process goes in the opposite direction. People lose money. Since they borrowed, they have to sell the asset in order to repay the loan. The asset goes down further. Fear takes hold. And you have a huge overreaction in the opposite direction. We'd come to believe in this country that housing was the safest investment there was, and we'd come to believe that loaning money against houses was an extremely safe investment. And those ideas turned out not to be right. It was in many ways like the 13th chime of a clock. It caused people to doubt all that had come before. And so people no longer had confidence in AAA financial instruments that they once regarded as safe. And when people lose the sense of confidence and trust, and when real values are declining, that's when you get tremendous concerns about the health of the financial system. And so it was the combination of huge greed, very high levels of leverage, and a sharp reversal that has brought us to this point. All that said, Tom, and I don't minimize the risks at all in our current situation. All you have to do is look at what happened to Japan in the 1990s to see how serious bursting bubbles can be. I don't think anything remotely like the Depression, where 25% of the people were unemployed for years and years, where most houses were one way or another foreclosed. I don't see anything like that as being in prospect here. And I think because there is a similarity of some of the mechanisms, people have confused that similarity of some of the mechanisms with similarity of the effects, which I think is something that's really very unlikely in the modern world.
Is it possible that the difference this time, at least over many decades that have come before, is that our financial system has sort of escaped the regulatory structure that the Great Depression brought about, that was put into place in the 1930s to get banking under control, to keep an eye on things, to keep things from getting too out of whack? Has our financial system sort of burst out of that corral and put us back into a different kind of danger?
There are clearly going to be some lessons for regulation here. And clearly, regulators can't be celebrating the job they did. I think particularly egregious were the mortgages that were lent to subprime homeowners where people didn't ask what their income was. People didn't ask any questions about their ability to repay. They just sort of assumed the houses would go up, and so the whole thing would work out. And regulators should have been more on top of that than they were. On the other hand, I think that it's always tempting after one of these episodes to just think that if you have smarter regulation, you can avoid the crisis. And I think that may be asking a great deal. All kinds of investors, I mean, take the people who insure bonds. There's a whole businesses of bond insurance.
Warren Buffett
people
entered.
Warren Buffett is entering now. But the people who were in those businesses put put their fortunes behind bond, insuring bonds that are turning out on a huge scale to be no good. Well, you know, they, in retrospect, they look silly. But if they weren't able to figure it out with their fortunes online, I'm not sure we can be confident that a group of regulatory authorities in the government are going to see.
We're not so dazzled by these big money people. And for half a century, we had a banking system that did have some boundaries around it. Now the banking has moved out of old-fashioned banking, and you know, investment banks just aren't under the same guidance, aren't under the same oversight. Is that a structural risk for this economy?
I think you have to be very careful. Government lost what in today's dollars would be about $300 billion. Not that it had to loan to somebody in order to get paid, but that it just paid out and never saw again in the 1990 SNL crisis. Mm-hmm. It could conceivably come to that here, but that's certainly not where most of the estimates are. Clearly, we've seen that the lines between investment banks and ordinary banks are much less strong than we had supposed. And so there's going to need to be much more regulation in a variety of ways of investment banks than there used to be.
We're up against the clock here. Larry Summers, please stand by for a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with former U.S. Treasury Secretary, former President of Harvard, former Chief Economist at the World Bank, Lawrence Summers, about U.S. economic woes, Wall Street housing bailout plans, and what we need to do now. Before Congress just yesterday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said it's a difficult time for the economy. New York Senator Charles Schumer asked him to elaborate. Here's Bernanke first.
It's clearly a period of very slow growth, extending back to the fourth quarter of last year, and we are trying to set our policies appropriately for that situation.
Do you believe the economy is contracting right now?
Our estimates are that we're slightly growing at the moment, but we think that there's a chance that for the first half as a whole, there might be a slight contraction.
Bernanke, not so sunny right there. Earlier in the week, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who has the job that Larry Summers once had, discussed his new plan for bank regulation. He said it's not intended as a quick fix for current economic problems.
This blueprint addresses complex, long-term issues that should not be decided in the midst of stressful situations and should not be implemented to add greater burden to a market already under strain.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Larry Summers had that job. Larry Summers, first on Ben Bernanke. How do you think the Fed is doing so far in response to this? And do we come out with a changed Federal Reserve Bank role fundamentally in this country? Are they now more interventionist than they've ever been?
They've certainly intervened in an unprecedented way. I suspect it will be hard to put that genie completely back in the bottle. And I suspect that as a consequence, as we work on the regulatory structure, they will come to have a larger role in regulating investment banks. Of course, it should be emphasized that contrary to what many people say, investment banks are currently working to meet the same so-called Basel capital standards that banks meet in many respects, and they
working
are regulated
to, but
in
have
their
not
obligation.
Over years.
No, in the last several years, they actually have been under an obligation to meet those Basel capital standards.
In other words, cash they have in the bank against what they're lending.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that we're going to have to look at some new aspects of of what constitutes stability, because it's clear that Bear Stearns wasn't in a sustainable place. But if you looked at the kinds of ratios that our current regulatory framework emphasizes, ratios of capital to assets and so forth, Bear Stearns was in a satisfactory place according to those ratios. And so I think Secretary Paulson raised some significant issues when he talked about the question of what the role of the Fed was in combining the SEC and the CFTC and what the role of the Office of Thrift Supervision and stuff is, but I think the more profound questions are not about the organization chart of the financial regulators, but about what kinds of things financial regulation is trying to achieve. And I'd like to see less emphasis on the behavior of individual institutions and more emphasis on what might be called systemic stability. This problem that when times are good, things feel safe, and so people borrow more money and buy more. And when times are bad, people feel less safe, they're under more pressure, and so they delever and sell. And buying when things are up and selling when things are down creates more instability, not less instability. And so what economists call
the
pro-cyclicality of the market, but also the pro-cyclicality of regulation, because when you've lost money, then you're forced to sell in order to get your leverage down. And I think the question of how we address that pro-cyclicality is going to be a very important one in the years ahead.
Let me ask you just a simple question so we can understand where you're coming from. I mean, you're an economist. You understand man as an economic animal. And now you're with a hedge fund, and you're talking a lot about public policy. We're glad to have your voice in the conversation. But are those – do those interests line up? I mean, can you represent a hedge fund and represent disinterested public policy perspective at the same time, or are you part of the industry that we're talking about, bringing more regulation to here?
It's a fair question. My role in the hedge fund is to give them advice on how a variety of financial markets are likely to evolve, particularly some of the international financial markets, but also to some extent in the United States. I think for that reason, because I have an involvement with a hedge fund, I probably would decline to answer, just lest somebody think I was conflicted, some question that went particularly to regulatory policy vis-a-vis hedge funds. But I think on the question of how we can best maintain financial stability in the country, my sense is most interests are likely to coincide. I don't think anybody gains from financial instability. I think that's pretty much a loser for the people in the financial sector, and it's a loser for people in Main Street. So I think we can all pretty much think about what the best ways to contain what a serious economic problem is for the United States. And I've certainly been careful, precisely for the reason you suggest, not to get involved in speaking to any issues where somebody could think that my particular hedge fund has a particular kind of economic interest.
Big picture, then we'll come to Paulson's proposals here. But we've been in a period, and I have to admit, I've sat here at this table and been confused because we've been through a period where you had people with all kinds of very elaborate investment vehicles, special investment vehicles, and all the rest of stuff being packaged and, you know, really cutting edge markets driving lending and the whole credit business out into a space where I had not seen it before. I've had economists say this is a great American advantage because it gives our economy a kind of nimbleness and fluidity that few others have. Then we turn around and suddenly it seems like we're on the edge of a precipice, and it may be that all that was, you know, too far out there, that it was putting too much at risk. A few people making a lot of money, but the whole system put at risk because of it. So which is it? Are we coming to the end of a period where, you know, we sort of trusted in the markets no matter how wild and woolly to take care of themselves, and we've got to pull back some now for the stability of the core? Or is that a core competitive advantage for the United States to have that flexibility in our financial system that others have not had?
Like in most things, Tom, there's truth in both perspectives. I don't see how you can look at the success in the United States in the last 20 years and not see some flexibility of finance, the fact that people are willing to give money to two guys from Stanford who've written a thesis with an interesting algorithm that 10 years later becomes Google. That kind of flexibility is a huge contributors to efficiency. The fact that people who see ways to run public companies better are able to borrow money, pay a premium to the shareholders of those companies, and then in most cases actually succeed in running them to better. Those are real successes. Was every aspect of this innovation understood? Were there people who were irresponsible in not thinking about the risks? Absolutely. Would we be better off if there'd never been any innovation? I rather doubt it, but you probably can't really judge till you see the end of this episode. I think what will be necessary after this episode is for those in the private sector who've learned some painful lessons by losing money, for those in the public sector with responsibility, to try to understand as precisely and accurately as they can what happened, to change their borrowing and lending policies where that's appropriate, to change regulatory policies.
But you're leaving those decisions in private hands.
No, for public sector to change regulatory policies where that is appropriate. And I think I mentioned some examples, much tighter regulation of the way in which mortgages are offered to consumers, more Fed oversight of investment banking institutions, for example. But I think we'd be making a very serious mistake if we were to try to go back to some financial system of 25 years ago. I also think there's a tendency to romanticize the past. You know, in 1982, the Latin American countries defaulted.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the banks had lent 2.5 times as much capital as they had to those Latin American countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, the banks were insolvent and the government was able to jolly the situation along. Latin America basically lost a decade of economic growth while that took place. During the S&L crisis, we lost very large burdens on taxpayers. So I think it's a mistake to suggest that somehow before now, when we had a less modern financial system, everything was all that much more stable. If you look at by far the most violent recessions this country ever had, they were in 1958, since the Second World War, in 1958, in 1974, in 1982. It's been a generation since we had anything that was remotely as serious as the kind of recession we had with considerable frequency in the first 2 decades after the Second World War. So I think we do need to take stock and learn from this episode, but I think it's also important to be measured in the way we react.
Let's take some calls from our listeners here. From Glastonbury, Connecticut, we've got Les on the line. Hi, Les. You're on the air with Lawrence Summers.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. After listening to the Secretary's discussion here, it's not surprising to me how we got into this sort of mess with viewpoints like this having input into our economy. With all due respect to the former Secretary, all roads lead back to the Federal Reserve, not to the greedy little consumer who's just trying to make a buck. It all goes back to the Federal Reserve and their horrible policies with regards to interest rates that have precipitated these constant bubbles and the fact that they were supposed to be put into place in 1913 to provide a more stable economy. And, you know, they have failed miserably, and the idea of providing the Fed with more power is the most ridiculous idea on the face of the planet.
But do you think we'd really be better off if the Fed had less power, Les?
I think it would be better off if the Federal Reserve, if it did exist, was A, if the Treasury Secretary was allowed to be back on the board like that he was back when the Federal Reserve was first created. The Secretary is no longer part of the Federal Reserve Board. And secondly, that the Federal Reserve should be treated as it is, which is a private corporation that has a monopoly and a a partnership with the United States government.
Les, thanks for your call. Larry Summers, Les doesn't like Fed policy at all, maybe doesn't like the Fed much. There has been a lot of talk about whether or not Alan Greenspan, during his time at the helm, kept the bubbles up too high, was too generous with Fed policy, and kind of fed a fire that's now turned around on us. What do you say to that?
Hindsight's 20/20, and no doubt with the benefit of hindsight, Alan Greenspan would have made different decisions, and the Federal Reserve Board as a whole would have made some different decisions than they did. I think it's easy now to say interest rates were too low and that created this bubble in the early part of this decade without recognizing that there was a very real risk and threat of a deflation like that took place in Japan that did enormous damage. That threat was avoided. Now, taking it for granted that that threat was avoided, it's easy to say we wish interest rates had been higher. But at the time, that was an enormous risk that had to be guarded against. So I think the broad strategic orientation of monetary policy has been appropriate. I'm surprised by the caller's suggestion that we might be better off without a Federal Reserve. I think those who've studied the history of huge financial crisis every 7 or 8 years in the 30 years that preceded the Fed tend to think that something like the Fed was a necessity if stability was to be maintained. And certainly that's the decision that every other major country has come to. Would it be better if the Treasury Secretary was on the board of the Fed? As a former Treasury Secretary, I rather doubt it. I think that the caller's worried about too loose money creating bubbles. The more you brought the political pressures of people who report directly to the president to bear on monetary policy, the easier money you'd have, the more inflation, the bigger the bubbles, and ultimately the greater the instability. So I think keeping the Federal Reserve more insulated from politics is probably the wiser policy.
How worried are you about inflationary pressures now with current Fed policy? Clearly tempting or that problem?
Oh, I think much the greater risks in the current situation involve financial instability, declining prices, contraction of credit, and ultimately pressures in a deflationary direction. Clearly, we got to be paying attention to the inflation threat. Clearly, the Fed's got to be monitoring what's happening to inflation expectations. I think there's some things in terms of the way we manage our oil reserves, in terms of the way we set our agricultural policies that could be done that would help to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures in commodities. But I don't think inflation is the primary economic threat right now.
So is there room to lower interest rates further? Do you think they've just about gone as far as they can go?
Old Treasury Secretary habits die hard, so I'm not going to make a particular recommendation for the Fed. I think they've made clear that they're going to be watching the economy very carefully, both in terms of the financial system and in terms of the real economy, and they'll make an appropriate judgment as things unfold. Certainly there is room for further reduction in interest rates, but it's also important to remember that the lags are long, and so we're going to be seeing the effects of the cuts that have taken place for quite some time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with former U.S. Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard University, and chief economist of the World Bank, Lawrence Summers, about U.S. economic woes, Wall Street, housing, bailout plans, what we need to do now. Larry Summers, taking your questions and calls. Let's take one from Austin, Texas. We've got John calling. Hi, John. You're on the air with Lawrence Summers.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Summers. I was just wondering, we hear so many proponents of free market capitalism come on shows like this and talk about how it's unwise to have too much regulation, and they're so proud of the self-regulating nature of free market economies. So I'm wondering if free market regulation, or rather the self-regulation of free markets, is such a good thing. Why these bailouts? Why not just let these self-correcting entities self-correct?
Larry Summers, there's Bear Stearns. There's a proposal to put a lot of money up to help homeowners with the mortgages they can't handle. If the market's self-correcting.
I don't think you heard me say there was anything especially good about self-regulation. I don't think you heard me say that you can always rely on markets to be self-correcting. I think those propositions actually aren't correct. I think that a bailout like the one we saw has to, in a sense, be a last resort for policymakers. But I think policymakers faced a choice that weekend. And it was a very difficult choice, and there were no good alternatives. Alternative A was to allow Bear Stearns to fail, to accept the fact that there would then be a huge scramble for the cash from Bear Stearns, that anybody who owed Bear Stearns money would surely not pay it when it expected Bear Stearns to go bankrupt, when the difficulties at Bear Stearns would lead to contagion to a number of other institutions. And you might well see several major financial institutions fail with the attendant consequences for the stocks and the bonds and the money market funds of millions of Americans. Or the other alternative was to find some kind of ad hoc, clumsy solution in which the people who owned and managed Bear Stearns lost the vast majority of the money they had had a week before, and in which some sense of normalcy was returned, and people who had put their money in other institutions weren't put at great risk. As I look at that trade-off, I think it was a fairly clear choice not to do the experiment of seeing what a bankruptcy would bring. Would you want to put in place methods that made it more likely that you would avoid the need in the future? Of course you would. Do those involve government action and regulation? Of course they do. Can you expect those actions to be foolproof and that we'll never need a government bailout of any kind again? I don't think that would be a realistic promise to hold out.
Is Paulson's proposal sufficient?
I don't think Paulson's proposal is directed at very many of the major issues that this crisis raised.
It's then are not we still waiting?
It's not directed at the procyclicality of the regulation. It's not directed at the levels of capital and the way in which capital is measured. It doesn't get into the problem of what people in financial world call liquidity risk, the risk that there'll be a sudden panic and that institutions which are basically solvent won't be able to come up with liquidity will come up with liquidity quickly
enough.
Is
it the wrong medicine?
So it's not the wrong medicine. It's if you have a fire, you have to sort of decide what kind of fire is it. Is it a grease fire, in which case spraying water on it's going to make it worse? Is it a more conventional fire, in which case water is the answer? What types of approaches are right to the fire? You sort of have to decide those issues before you decide how the fire department is going to be organized.
But it sounds
and
like you're
Paulson's
saying
proposal
he's misdiagnosed
is the secretary. No, it's not misdiagnosed. It's just not diagnosed. And so the secretary is talking about the organization of the fire department when the more profound questions involve what kind of fire it is, what the causes of the fire were, and whether you organize the fire department in battalions or companies or regions or around different types of fires. It's better to get right than to get wrong, so there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not really the central issue that's involved in the crisis.
Are you still waiting then for an answer to the crisis that we're in the midst of from this administration?
Well, I think that not enough has been done. I mean, the administration has put forward these programs, these policies involving collaboration with collaboration with financial institutions to reduce mortgages, but they haven't really come to very much. And so I think we do need a much more systematic program to prevent foreclosures, to maintain communities when there are the inevitable level of foreclosures, to keep the flow of credit going in the municipal market, to keep the flow of credit going to student loans, to maintain the incomes of people who are really going to lose a great deal as unemployment increases through increased unemployment insurance. I think we do need a more activist set of responses to the current crisis if we're to maximize the chance that it's contained.
Has Congress got the right recipe when it comes to mortgages and foreclosures? They're talking about Barney Frank in the House, $300 billion, maybe more.
I think the general
to help people out of their mortgages to make them manageable.
Again, you know, it's really terribly important, I think, Tom, to distinguish when you talk about these figures. It is very different to buy something which you then sell than it is to give somebody money. And the large figures, like the $300 billion, are not government expenditures that are going to cost the taxpayer anything like $300 billion. They're not going to cost the taxpayer 20% of that. I think the general direction that Congressman Frank is going is very much the right one. Whether it's ultimately whether his legislation has the exact details right, I'm not altogether certain. But I think the direction of seeking to encourage the writing down of mortgages so that you avoid extraordinarily costly foreclosures, I think that basic impulse is right.
Larry Summers, stand by for just a moment. I want to get another perspective just for a few minutes here from Washington. We're joined by Robert Samuelson, columnist at Newsweek and The Washington Post. Robert Samuelson, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Got Larry Summers here, and very happy to have him. He's got a big view. You've been writing very recently, this is not how to save housing, what Barney Frank is proposing. Why not?
Well, I let me say I agree with everything Larry said up until about 30 seconds ago. The fundamental problem in the housing market today, in my view, is that homes are too costly. That's what the bubble meant. Home prices got too high. And they were supported at those high levels by a deterioration in credit standards, which allowed people who shouldn't have been able to borrow and buy homes, and then the prices went up.
Yep.
Now that we've had a tightening of credit standards, you have fewer people can or are willing to buy homes at the prices that are now prevailing. And to restart the market, to clear off the excess inventories of homes, the fundamental solution is to let the price fall. And the sooner it falls, the faster demand will revive, the faster these inventories will be sold, and the faster construction will restart. And anything that really impedes that process or delays it, it seems to me, will ultimately have a perverse reaction in the housing market.
So you're saying let people take the whack. Let them take the pain because there's no other way to get...
Well, I would say that if they can renegotiate, if borrowers and lenders can renegotiate existing loans and write them down voluntarily, that's fine. But to insert the government and to have the government, in effect, guarantee the resulting loans, I think, is bad policy.
Let me put that to Larry Summers, if I may, Bob. Larry, I'm looking here at Paul McCauley being quoted, managing director of the big investment company PIMCO. And he's looking at, a kind of safety net put out to help some of these mortgage borrowers. And he says, the inequities smell to high heaven. The fool is going to be rewarded, and I, the taxpayer, will be put at risk at the margin for the handout to the fool. Where's the fairness here?
I think all these arguments are legitimate, and I rather share Bob Samuelson's impulse that we want to let house prices find their appropriate level. I think there are two aspects of the situation that he's not really grappling with in making that the sole focus of his argument.
Mm.
The first is that there are all kinds of legal obstacles to the renegotiation that he calls for and to the writing down of mortgages, and that the foreclosure process itself is enormously costly and dissipative of value.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the government is able, through an appropriate intervention, to encourage negotiated solutions that bring down the price of houses to a proper market level, but when the person who basically is best suited to live in that house and who will pay the most for it is the person who's already living there, we should avoid a lot of terribly economically destructive musical chairs associated with the foreclosure process. And I think there's the possibility to do that. I think the second point, and it's a more subtle one, is that if one looks at the pricing of mortgages in the United States right now, and in particular the pricing of these mortgage-backed securities.
Do you mean the interest rates that consumers pay?
No, I mean
the
bonds.
Okay.
If I've lent you if I've provided you with a mortgage, I'm expecting a stream of payments from you, but who knows how long you'll stay in the house.
What's the value on that?
Who knows what the risk will be? Mm-hmm. So what's the value of that mortgage?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the pricing of mortgages right now, it is, frankly, pricing in Armageddon in the housing market. It's pricing in exposures of 50% foreclosures, very radical outcomes.
Much higher than
that none of us would predict. And it's doing that because of a variety of these problems in financial markets where people have been forced to sell huge amounts of this stuff and there are no very natural buyers. And so the government's intervening in the situation to bring some normalcy to that mortgage market has the prospect of averting panic that wouldn't have any very desirable benefit in terms of letting things find their level. But the reason why when you asked me about Congressman Frank's legislation, I said I thought something in that direction was probably appropriate, but I was very careful to say that there are a range of tactical questions, is that I think the line between propping up markets in a futile way that ultimately magnifies the pain, as the Japanese did, and controlling panic is a very fine one. And Bob is absolutely right to warn of the dangers of trying to interfere with a necessary and desirable adjustment process. I just think in making policy, you also have to be conscious of the other sets of risks that desirable negotiations won't happen voluntarily and that you're seeing panic levels of pricing in some markets.
Bob Tamminson, are you persuaded? And I guess you're sitting in Washington. Do you think this package is going to go through as proposed?
Well, On the second question, Republican and Democratic leaders agreed to a package yesterday that did not include this large-scale refinancing or providing FHA guarantees for mortgages, although it's still on the table and it's unclear. I don't know whether it will go through or not. And again, I agree with what Larry said. There are a huge number of administrative and legal uncertainty surrounding the renegotiation process. And but in talking with the architects of this proposal, I could not find any – they didn't give me any explanation as to why this proposal would sweep away any of these practical problems, except for the fact that federal money – or the guarantee of federal money would be put on the table and therefore make it more attractive possibly to some of these lenders to negotiate. But it's not clear that any of those practical problems would be, in a legal sense, swept away. So I'm a little bit concerned that basically what the government is just going to try to do here is throw money at it. And there is this moral issue that the economist you quoted raised, and it's an important one because there could be a backlash here. In other words, you're taking people who bought homes between the beginning of 2005 and July of 2007 and are devoting excessive amounts of their incomes to mortgage payments. In other words, acted irresponsibly.
And you're cutting them a break.
And you're giving them a break, and somebody who stood on the sidelines or who borrowed earlier or who was more prudent doesn't get their mortgage cut 20 or 30%, and they say, why them and not me?
Robert Simonson, let me put that to Larry Summers, if I may. You raise big and important questions here, and we appreciate your doing it from your perch at Newsweek and the Post. Thanks for joining us to do that. I just got another minute with the Secretary, Larry Summers. In all of this, what about the moral hazards, whether it's the bankers or the people who took out mortgages maybe they couldn't afford? I mean, do we come through this adjustment with our sort of moral settings relative to the economy still intact enough that we start off on a new clean foot here?
there are adverse moral hazard consequences, but you know, the fact that somebody smoked in bed is not usually thought of as a reason not to call the fire department, particularly when their house is very near other houses. And you have to make judgments about what's going to be best for the economy as a whole. I think Bob Samuelson is right about some of the inequities that are involved here. It's mitigated by the fact that many of these people were sold their mortgages on false pretenses. It's been calculated that almost half the people who get subprime mortgages, in fact, could have gotten prime mortgages and just were misled in one way or another by the people who sold them their mortgage. So I think it's a little more complicated, and I would be a little more inclined to place more of the blame on the mortgage servicers and the financial industry that's going to be seeing the value of its mortgage written down, and a little less of the blame on the individuals. But again, when you're dealing with financial crisis, none of the choices are attractive. And the policy challenge is to find the least unattractive choice. And I think running the risk that this thing is going to spiral downwards, as situations like this in other countries have done, is taking a big risk on everyone's behalf. And that's why I favor more active solutions.
And there's the spot we're at right now. Lawrence Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, thanks for being with us. This is On Point.
Thank you.